Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, January 1, 2018, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape, the way we like to start off every new year. Just steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. 2018. We made it, folks. Well, I think we made it. I mean, I'm pre-taping this. It's not inconceivable that we didn't make it. And if we didn't make it, and I'm just recording this for the ether, then we had a good run. We probably deserved it. If we didn't make it, we probably deserved not to make it.
Maybe in a few millennia, some new intelligent life forms will come across and hear this.
Dude, I always said we would have all been much better off if we were just floating orbs anyways. Just like little collections of energy that floated around, weren't such dicks about everything. That's what I... So, if we... If we made it, then here's the way. Then we need to do something about going forward. If we didn't make it, then you can stop listening. But if we made it, you're going to need some advice on how we move forward from here. We've just been through the first year of the Trump administration, and I should say even more importantly, total Republican rule, and it's not been good. It's been bad. Is there hope, though? Yes. And this is why. I want to start off 2018 with a very hopeful, I think, interview. And it was hopeful, not in a sort of, smell the roses type of way. It was hopeful in the sense that, like, look, there's people out there who are organizing. There are people out there who are learning to do things right. I mean, if you look at the wins that took place in places like Virginia and Alabama, there has been a renewed focus on the ground organizing, on knocking on doors, on contacting voters, on telling them about how important this election is, whichever election it was, giving them face-to-face connections and reasons to vote. And much of that is a function of lessons that were learned in the 2016 race. And two proponents of that type of organizing came off of the Bernie Sanders campaign. One you may know, she's been on this program in the past from her work as a at Credo Mobile. Becky Bond, and the other is Zach Exley. They were both on the Bernie Sanders campaign. They had a book that came out in November, I guess, 18th of 2016. And they were on the program. I hope we didn't do this wrong. They were on in 2016. You son of a gun, Matt. Yeah, it's supposed to be best of 2017. That's all right. We're going to stretch it. We gonna stretch it because we would have put them on the best of.
Well,
in
that's
2016.
The thing is we never include recent
that's
ones
right.
at the best.
That's right. You're right. I'm right. Yeah, I mean, you're right, and I'm wrong, Matt. And we're not going to start off 2018 in a way where I'm wrong and you're not right. So, the book is Rules for Revolutionaries: How Big Organizing Can Change Everything, and it's quite possible. Look, this is the year, folks. Got to take back Congress. Got to take back the House. Would be good to take back the Senate. Would be even better, in my mind, to take back the Senate than the House. Because I don't want Donald Trump to appoint any more judges. You know that about me. I mean, maybe you know about yourself, too. But that's my ballywick. So we're starting off 2018 with Becky Bond and Zach Exley, lessons from Rules for Revolutionaries, how big organizing can change everything. We may have a couple of fun half clips. And tomorrow, we will all be back, all of us, to kick off 2018 with you, our audience. And let me just say, I hope you had a great new year. And I want to thank all of our listeners. If you listen to the free show, thank you very much. We don't do this because, I mean, for the primary reason why we do this is because we want people to listen to the shows. It would suck. I mean, I could probably live with the idea that you're all just going to send me a check and I just in my, you know, just hanging out and playing video games. But at the end of the day, the reason why we do this is for people to listen. So I want to thank you if you listen to the free show, and if you are a member and you support this show, I want to thank you. 2017 was a very difficult year for a lot of people, And for me, the big thing that came out of it is, as difficult as it was, the relationship I have with you, the audience, as a mass of people and as individuals, is really special and really gratifying. And that's about as sentimental as I get. So I want to thank you. Thank you for 2017. Thank you for 2018. Thank you for listening. Enjoy Becky Bond and Zach Exley. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to both welcome back for one person and have on the program for the first time Becky Bond and Zach Exley. They are the authors of Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. Both of them served as senior advisors on Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. Welcome to the program, Becky and Zach.
Oh, it's great to be here.
All right, let's start with, I mean, you know, when we booked this interview, I think we were anticipating, or at the very least hoping, for a different outcome. And I want to circle back to that aspect as to, has anything changed from what you prescribe based upon the outcome of this election? And maybe we can talk about maybe different strategies. But first, I want to talk about where... what this came out of this book, Zach. At what point did you and Becky say, we've got to write this?
Well, I actually, it did not occur to me to write it because I knew that I would actually not get anything like this done. So and Becky had the perfect strategy for getting it done. And so we holed up in a cabin and we just banged it out. And so, you know, it was, I think it was in this, but I think our real impulse to write this was, you know, to make sure that what happened on our little fringe of the campaign, because, we weren't the Bernie campaign. We weren't the Bernie organizing campaign. We were this distributed organizing team is what we came to be called. And, you know, we started with a couple of people, Claire Sandberg and myself, and then Becky joined us, and we were able to hire a few more people. It was always a very small team. And our job was to organize people in all of the states where there was no field staff on the ground. And over time, field staff did come into some of those states, and then we wound up working with them, and they kind of, you know, took over the show at that point. And we knew that was going to happen, and we had this weird little team that was trying to, for once, make this huge mass of volunteers in an insurgent presidential campaign, we were to actually make them really effective at turning out votes. And we, our main lever to do that with them was by building a phone banking system, which Becky really was the one who, you know, enabled us to build that. And you know, we learned a lot. It was the first time that something on this scale happened, you know, in non-staffed states. On this scale of organizing, and you know, in a presidential campaign, and maybe in any kind of a actually, you know, focused, you know, staffed campaign, And we just wanted to make sure that the lessons kind of got written down and got out there. And, you know, there was so much great innovation on the Obama campaign in 2008, but all those people went into the White House and were not able to pause and write. So, you know, the one thing we had going for us after Bernie lost the nomination was we, you know, had the luxury of sitting down and writing this stuff up.
Yeah, so, I mean, and actually, you know, part of the story was someone who's been involved in progressive politics for or progressive activism and social change movements for a long time, Alison Barlow. And she's someone who has been involved in the Progressive Foundation world. And she sat me down right before the New York primary, and she said, Becky, there are so many social justice groups, and a lot of them, you know, don't have a lot of resources, and they really need to learn some of the powerful organizing lessons that you guys are learning on the Bernie campaign. You know, can you write down some of the lessons so that we can share them with these social justice groups? And she really said it was really important to do this now. Because there are so many big urgent challenges. And so, you know, it was really from her making it clear that we needed to do it. And I thought, yeah, we need to, instead of having people have to hire consultants from the Bernie campaign and only groups that can pay can, you know, sort of learn a lot of the things that we learned, let's put it in a book and then we can share it with everyone. Not just organizations, but some of the super volunteers who organize their own city, and give them a reference book so that they can actually keep doing this work.
So, all right. So to be clear, basically you guys were the, we would call you on a military campaign, you'd be the irregulars essentially. Right.
And, yes.
Tell us specifically, what is distributed organizing?
So distributed organizing, you know, and on a lot of campaigns, this is called the digital organizing department. And so, you know, distributed organizing is how we use technology to get people to do actual, real, valuable work, no matter where they are in terms of geography and no matter what time, you know, they have available to work. So we basically take a central plan and we distribute the work to people all over the country, but they're all working towards the same goal.
Now, I mean, how does that work, Zach, on the context of a campaign? I mean, what is it? Are you just encouraging? Is it all just phone banking? I mean, how did people from your, I guess, slice of this campaign, how did they contact, what did they do once they were organized, I guess?
Well, that's the thing. So when Claire and I first joined the campaign and kind of got these 46 states, at the time, it was 46 states that were not staffed. And we literally had hundreds of thousands of people that had signed up to volunteer and that were really angry because we were not putting them to work. And I mean, you know, we got like, you know, really hostile phone calls. I mean, most people were very understanding, but understandably, we got, you know, very, very hostile people reaching out to us sometimes. And we totally respected that. And we felt like we were letting them down every day. And so we were scrambling to try to, you know, give people direction to go in. But the interesting thing was that, you know, the thing that helps win elections is voter contact, is talking to other voters. And we, unfortunately, we didn't have access for a while to the kinds of tools that help voters do voter contact or help volunteers do voter contact in a systematic way. Like, we did not have, you know, the voter activation network, the VAN, which is this, you know, tool that lets people go knock on their neighbor's doors and record the results and all that stuff. We just didn't have that. We weren't allowed to roll that out to the volunteers. And so it was when, finally, when Becky joined us. Well, now, don't get me wrong. We gave people all kinds of stuff to do, but they knew they weren't, you know, we said, go out and recruit volunteers. You know, hold leafleting events, hold flyering events and, you know, discussions and, you know, bands for Bernie for the purpose of signing up volunteers. But people knew that, you know, they could have been doing more. So it wasn't until Becky joined us, you know, about a month later or so. And she had this experience from the Credo Super PAC where they really, you know, empowered these volunteer-led campaigns all over America in many different races at the same time to do voter contact. And their main tool also was phone banking. So she really knew the technology and, you know, knew that this could work. And, you know, and we built a team, you know, she built a team around herself to actually implement it on this ridiculous scale.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically just the idea that, you know, the most powerful way that you can organize to move voters to the polls is for a volunteer to talk to them. And it could be their doorstep, and it could be on the phone. We did a lot of this by text message also. So what we were really trying to do was build a giant voter contact machine that volunteers could be part of no matter where they lived. Because we wanted to give everybody something to do that could materially help Bernie win the contests, especially the early ones.
Okay, so you guys have outlined 22 rules. What, Becky? Give me your what you think is the most important one.
Hey, wait. Actually, can I back up for a second though?
Sure.
And I just want to add something to what we're talking about because it's I think it goes to an important place. Is that what wound up happening? You know, as we got closer and closer to Iowa, and then we got into those those early states. Was we had this national voter contact capacity that was really huge. And we had the capacity to actually call every voter on the Nevada voter file list. Every voter that we had a phone number for, we could call every day. We actually had that big of a capacity at, when we actually got up to Nevada. Just imagine if we, this is why we wanted to write this stuff down and make sure that future campaigns understand this. There are so many people that are desperate to get involved and make a difference. And we only scratched the surface of the capacity that was out there to organize because, we got started so late,
right?
Bernie kind of, announced that he was running, not incredibly late, but later than he could have, and with no infrastructure. There was almost nothing, on his campaign when he announced. So it took a long time, we were only really just starting to be able to grow quickly when we got close to Iowa. So that was a real shame. If we could have kept, if we had had another 6 months, we would have had enough people mobilized and organizing and making calls to, perhaps even call a really huge chunk of the voters, like a very significant slice of the voters in all of the Super Tuesday states, for example. So,
well, let me ask you, you bring that up because, when I talk about why I think Bernie Sanders didn't win, and nobody knows, these are all, everybody's just sort of has an opinion on this. But for me, I think 6 months is really the first answer I have. If Bernie Sanders had gotten into the race, let's say 9 months before he did, with a determination that and a belief that, I don't even think he would have needed it when he got in to believe that he could have won, because I think he would have come to that realization in the same amount of time. It just would have been 9 months earlier. Let me ask you, I don't know how fair of a question this is, but if you had two guys had to pick one thing that would have was the but for in terms of Sanders, would simply time have been the difference?
We might have different answers on this, but I think that would have been one thing. Yeah, I think that would have made all the difference. And notice that we're blaming factors internal to our campaign, and not factors.
We will get to that. We will get to that. Yes,
not things that we could not control.
Well,
outside of our campaign, but no, that would have made a huge difference. And then, of course, all the little errors that that we ourselves, personally made in execution. You want to go back and do all those things
right.
Over. There's so many decisions that.
But there's always a 10% contingency built into every project you do, right? You always are going to mess up a certain amount. So it's really and I think that's true of any endeavor. Becky, what about from your perspective?
Yeah, I think, if we had started earlier, that would have helped a lot. And I also think, it took us a while to learn some of the lessons that are in the book. And we knew that we had to build a campaign from volunteers, and we knew we could trust them to do big things. But I don't think we really, in the beginning, we really got it. So, for example, we encouraged volunteers to organize phone banks, in the later states to call into the early states like Iowa and Nevada. But, what we didn't do is we didn't empower them in the fall to start canvassing their own neighborhoods because they would have made the calls into the early states and they also would have been starting the canvassing and working on the voter list where they lived. And we didn't, we told them to wait, that they had to wait, and that we couldn't help them do that so early that their turn would come. And, you know, I think that in some parts we worried that if they were organizing in their states, we wouldn't have enough people that were organizing to help us win the crucial early contests. But in retrospect, I think they would have done all of it. And basically, you know, one of the
it would have enhanced both of their jobs. If you're going door to door, you're getting a sense of what the arguments or the appeals you're going to make on the phone and vice versa.
Yeah. And you're getting better at it and capacity is growing. But, you know, what we learned was that people are just waiting to be asked to do something big if the reward is going to be that you're going to win something truly big. And so we did ask people to do big things, but I think we could have asked them to do even bigger things. And, you know, people can't canvass effectively without being able to access and then contribute to the central voter file for the campaign. And that was something the volunteers could not do without us making it a priority. And so if we could do it again, you know, we would give access to the voter file, the campaign voter file, to the volunteers in the states from the very beginning.
You know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, when I hear that, you know, like one of the things that I think my sense is about, you know, the idea of being able to give the volunteers more work and in many respects more responsibility too. The thing that strikes me is one of your lessons. I'm going to pick one of them out because is the tyranny of the annoying is because the concern I think that broadly speaking these endeavors have, particularly ones that are sort of mixed paid and volunteer, is that the volunteers, like, it's going to get out of control. Like, it's something's going to spin out of control because there's going to be, or not so much just sort of like iron clenched control, but just that people are going to go, you know, sort of like hog wild or whatnot, or people are going to derail something. And So tell us about the tyranny of the annoying, because on some level, like, you're both willing to give a more responsibility than I think people generally feel comfortable doing in this context. But at the same time, you're also willing to sort of pull the plug and tell people you got to move on.
Well, the key, though, is, you know, we gave volunteers responsibility. The key is that we gave volunteers as much responsibility as we could, but that went along with a structure and accountability. And so people had roles. They knew what, you know, when it was working and, you know, when we were setting it up right, they had roles and they knew what their goals were. And, you know, and we could measure those goals. And it was hard. It was really hard to get that set up, to get that kind of accountability set up. But, you know, eventually we did get it with the phone banking. We got it with a few other things. So it's, you know, it is important, you know, that you know, to not get the idea that our message is, yeah, just like let everybody go do cool stuff and it'll be great. And yeah, the tyranny of the annoying is one of the, it's one of our rules is defeat the tyranny of the annoying. And, you know, this is a phrase that, you know, we've kind of used for a long time. And, you know, one of the reasons why, if you don't give people clear structure and roles and have accountability, is there's this tiny minority of people. I mean, it's really just like 1 in 100 people that are just sort of determined, you know, they're just really counterproductive. They want to take over the group, you know,
did this come out of like the General Assemblies? It reminds me of like sort of what sometimes would derail like the General Assemblies in Occupy on some level.
But
one
person with their
specific agenda and everyone has to bend to it.
But it's just universal. That wasn't specific to Occupy. That's in every single group.
Yeah, and when you think about it, I mean, the people that come to get to work, if they find their time is wasted because organizers are too polite to shut someone down who's brought their own agenda to a group and is taking up too much time, you know, then these disruptive people, no matter how well intentioned they are, they're hurting the movement. And so we really wanted the people that wanted to come to work and they were heads down and they were good on a team. And so that was our responsibility then when people were, you know, wasting the time of the group, you know, to be able to move those people out so that other people could continue to do good work. And I think this is something, as liberals, people really feel like everybody's entitled to take up space into their own opinion. But you really have to respect volunteers and the time they're putting in. And, you know, if you have a room full of 100 people, you can't let, you know, someone, even if they just take up 5 hours talking about something that's not on the agenda, if they just take 5 minutes, you multiply that by 100 people, and it's hours of wasted time. Right. And we just couldn't afford to let that go.
All right, I want to turn to a piece that you guys wrote in I think it was Huffington Post, I believe. I'm not sure where I actually pulled this from, but it is.
Yeah, it was Huffington Post.
Okay, and I mention it just because, I mean, we're pre-taping this, but on today's program, I spent 15, 20 minutes on the phone with a guy who argued essentially what you argued in this piece, and he had lived it in Pennsylvania, which is that Hillary Clinton's get-out-the-vote operation may have turned out Trump voters. Now, his argument was that there was essentially a piece of data that existed in the partisan index, essentially, that voter files have, that was wrong as to whether or not it was predictive of them voting for Clinton. Give me, and that's a rough summation, but give me the summation of your argument, Zach.
Well, I think Becky has more to say I just wanted to start though by saying that it's, like, the reason we wanted to write that was because of we wanted to point to this other way of going about things, and that there's a paradigm shift that we should really be having right now. And, you know, because of, you know, what we were just talking about how it's actually possible to mobilize enough people to identify who your supporters are, not by modeling, you know, so we got all excited about big data and modeling, but actually, we have the capacity if we can, you know, excite volunteers and give them something big to work for, to actually ask people, who are you supporting?
So Becky, so what went wrong here? This big data versus big organizing, what went wrong?
Well, here we have a lot of questions, right? And so what we're doing is we're throwing out questions because obviously, you know, the Democrats lost an election that they should have won, and the implications are enormous and dangerous. And so, you know, what we've seen anecdotal evidence of and what your caller saw was that, you know, we were hearing from people who did GOTV. So they were getting out the vote, a list of voters that were supposed to be for Clinton, and they were knocking on their doors or calling them or sending them text messages on election day. And they were finding that they were reaching a lot of people who were enthusiastic Trump supporters. And, you know, there could be a few things wrong with your walk list on election day. But by the time election day comes around, these lists should be pretty much, you should only be talking to your campaign supporters, right? And people that have been identified as your campaign supporters. And so there could be, you know, like a couple mistakes every once in a while. But the numbers we were hearing from people, we thought maybe there's something wrong. And the reason why we bring this up in part is that we think that it is a symptom of a sort of a problematic attitude towards organizing that's part of how the Democratic Party runs elections. And it's this what we call a small organizing approach. And what happens with most federal elections is a candidate will hire consultants, often an expensive firm, that will take a look at the voters in the district, and they'll come up with a plan. Who are the fewest people that you can talk to and turn out to win the election? And it's often a slice of swing voters. You figure the base will turn out at a certain amount, and then you've got these swing voters, and so then you just sort of do a turnout operation on that. And the people that run the campaign really try, they don't try to talk to as many people as they can. And when election day comes, these consultants, they take the list that they've modeled, and some volunteers come in, and then they basically try and turn out everybody on the list. And you know, there's another way to do politics, and this is how we did it on the Bernie campaign, but how a lot of grassroots candidates do the work is you take a big approach to organizing, and that means you have, you know, a candidate and a message that is really resonates with the people, and so you're able to get a lot of volunteers. And those volunteers talk to as many people as they can, not as few people. And they talk to people, and they hear about their concerns, and they find out, you know, each individual voter that they reach at the door on the phone, are they for your candidate? Are they against your candidate? Do they need persuading? And then when election day comes along, you have this list of people that you've already talked to, and an influx of other volunteers come and continue this conversation and turn people out on election day. And the problem with the small organizing approach is that if you get some assumption in your model wrong, right, and we wonder if there was an assumption that was in the model that was wrong, and these models really rely heavily on party preference, and that might have been part of it. If there's assumption, then it can have disastrous results. not even that you don't turn out some people that you should, but that you might have your volunteers turning out some of your opponent's voters. And so, and you know, if there was a feedback loop where you were regularly talking to voters, you'd be hearing back, you know, our messages are or aren't resonating, or wow, you know, we got some Trump voters, we need to look into this. I mean, and in fact, Debbie Dingell, who's the congresswoman from Ann Arbor, was, you know, actually, yes, you know, actually spoke in public and said, I was trying to tell the Clinton campaign that we were in trouble in Michigan. And, you know, there was just nowhere from this feedback from people on the ground to go that, it's not that there's nowhere, we have to wonder what happened to the feedback from people on the ground when they got it. And were they not talking to enough people to actually know what was going on? Because, you know, there certainly was enough volunteers in the state of California, you know, that in the last week before the election, that if they had been on a dialer, they could have called every single number in Michigan to recalibrate the model and see an ID who should really be turned out on election day.
And so, yeah. I mean, what is it about that? What was it about the campaign, or just, I mean, is there something ideological that runs in here, or is it? I mean, is it stuff like it's just, you know, the consultant that they get hired? There's more money in doing it a different way for them. I mean, like, I'm looking at like the advertising that took place in L.A. versus Milwaukee, and we, you know, there's no explanation for it other than the fact that L.A. has got a much more expensive media market, and if I'm getting 10% commission, I'm gonna buy my ads in L.A. as opposed to Milwaukee, particularly if it's just very lucrative for me to assume Milwaukee's in the bag.
Yeah, you know, that's a good, I wish people would ask the campaign that question. So why did they make these decisions? Was it because they had a hard time recruiting volunteers? You know, they never implemented a dialer for out-of-state volunteers. I don't know if they had them in the States.
That was crazy. That was crazy.
So I'm not sure.
That very strange. All right, so let me ask you this. I mean, with you know, at the very least.
Well, and also.
Go ahead.
Wait, and just on that, you know, I mean, there's, you know, like, what is the expression? Wednesday morning quarterbacking?
Monday.
What is that?
Monday morning.
Monday morning quarterbacking. Okay, right. Right, I see somebody was joking about Wednesday. Okay, yeah. So there's Monday morning. Yeah, so this would be Wednesday morning quarterbacking because it's the day after the election. But anyway, so there's the, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking. That's, you know, the thing is, that's what happens after a football game, you know, because who cares about a football game? The problem is that we actually, you know, there are decisions being made right now about who's going to run the Democratic Party,
right,
about what kind of people are going to staff the Democratic Party. You know, candidates have to make decisions, you know, about what they're going to do, how they're going to build their campaigns going forward. So this is a conversation that absolutely has to happen. And, you know, it's really sad. I mean, you know, I worked on the Kerry campaign, I worked on the Dean campaign. We both worked on the Bernie campaign. We both had many losses. We know how bad it feels to lose. And we've critiqued our own losses, you know, right after we've had them, actually. But we also know how it feels when other people critique them. It doesn't feel good. But, you know, when somebody like Donald Trump is allowed to win and, you know, really setting our whole country in a totally different direction and a very scary direction, then we have no other choice but to, you know, get on it right away and figure out, you know, not, and, you know, and this isn't about figuring out like, oh, did this person make this mistake? It's not about that at all. And that's absolutely not what we and, you know, others that are trying to figure out this stuff are talking about. You know, it's about the philosophy and the approach to politics and organizing.
Well, this is also, I mean, it's a sort of a corollary to the tyranny of the annoying, is that, like, look, we can't afford to make this about people's feelings at this point. I mean, it's not, you know, nobody's looking to bring anybody into the town square and put them in the stockade. But the bottom line is, like, this is a major, major, major screw up with massive, horrible implications. And that's the best case scenario, it seems to me. It could even get worse than that. So this stuff is really important to get wrong. I mean, get right. And it's, you know, I mean, the fact is, I mean, the real question is there something, To me, I don't know that there's an answer, but from the ideology that made these mistakes more possible. I mean, I feel like there were decisions made by the campaign, the Clinton campaign, to go for, these suburban Republican voters that I think was misguided and impacted both their rhetoric and their lack of a message that they wanted to give to bring these other people out. I mean, you know, that's the other question is, was it absolutely necessary? I mean, was it a lack of a message that made it possible for people to knock on that door and find out that they're talking to a Trump voter? Could that person in another universe been a Clinton voter? Or was that person always a Trump voter, just a low propensity voter? I mean, just give me your opinion on that, Becky.
Well, I think, you know, to the extent to which you have a lot of people that voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, and some of those voters voted for Trump, they were gettable voters, right? And so there's been lots of speculation about, you know, why those voters went to Trump. And then there's also a lot of people that voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 who just didn't turn out, right? And I think we can assume on a certain level that they weren't motivated to vote, right? And it probably had a lot of factors in it, but one of it could be, you know, they weren't motivated, to vote for more of the same. So I think, what we saw with the Bernie Sanders campaign was that people, they heard Bernie's message and they were motivated to vote for him and to volunteer for him because they shared his political analysis about taking back power from the corporations and the 1%. And having government work for the people again, and that really motivated people. We didn't have that message in the general election, or at least we didn't have it the Democrats didn't have it.
All right. So, I reached out to you for this interview, maybe over, I don't know, whatever. It was before the election. And I anticipated that we would be talking, obviously, about your book, but how the... I don't know what you want to call it, the Bernie Sanders wing, the Elizabeth Warren wing, the more populist, the more grassroots wing of the Democratic Party begins to push Hillary Clinton to the left and to, focus on a whole policy, a set of policy issues that we want to change. Obviously, that's we're in a different scenario now. I want to hear from both of you, and I know we're running out of time here, but Zach, from your perspective, what do we need to do now? Like, how do we take the tools that you're giving us here and just like more broadly speaking, how do we play defense in this situation? And I'm going to add another layer to this. I remember the aughts and the idea that... I was fighting alongside people against the Bush administration who by 2009, I realized like we weren't exactly on the same side on these issues. Right.
Yeah,
I mean, there was a bit of a popular front. Mm-hmm. How do we maintain the integrity of the more left issue perspective, but at the same time also, where do we have to do we have to make compromises to fight Donald Trump so that we're not going backwards too far?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a lot of playing defense, but we also in some really important ways, right? Like when Trump decides to actually go for, deporting some number of millions of people, of our neighbors, right? But I think we have to play offense. What just happened, the way Trump got elected was, as we've been saying, that there really wasn't a compelling vision on the other side, right? And the Clinton campaign just, didn't have an answer for how Hillary Clinton was going to, or even just what her vision was to get incomes going back up again, to get job participation going up, to take on mass incarceration, to deal with police violence and a whole bunch of other stuff. There was no vision there. There was just you know, kind of empty slogans, right? And you know, to the extent that there were policy positions, it was, you know, it was stuff that was clearly, you know, just weak, compromised stuff. Like, instead of free college tuition, it was make college more affordable, you know, that kind of thing. And instead of, you
know,
and
we never heard that in the general. I mean, the fact is that it was sitting on the website, but we never heard it was never that was
right,
never
right, right.
the banner that was carried. It was just Donald Trump is a moral monster, and that's it.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, yeah. And so I think that's why that's why the Clinton campaign lost. That's what gave Trump this chance. And also, part of what gave Trump his chance was, you know, yes, xenophobia, yes, racism, and also because everybody, you know, everybody to some extent on that Republican GOP stage was talking about, not everybody, but, oh, you know, sorry, let me start that over, that, you know, a whole lot of those candidates on the GOP primary stage were talking in really xenophobic terms of, you know, deporting millions and millions of people. For example, they also were talking about that. Why did Trump win? It was partly because he talked about these economic issues that in very stark, specific, graphic ways, right? And he really ran far to the left of Hillary Clinton on the economy. And you know, while he didn't have a totally coherent economic vision, he painted a very graphic picture of factories being built in, you know, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan communities. He went all over those states and painted this picture over and over and over, and did fill in, you know, enough details to make it credible. So what we need to do is we need to get a vision together for the American people of a multiracial, multiethnic, feminist movement that is also talking about income and jobs, right? And we have to do that. And if we don't do that, that's not to say this is all about class. Hey, everybody, let's just talk about class. Let's stop talking about all this race and, you know, stuff. That's absolutely wrong, because that's also a path to losing and losing and losing. Right. And it's the immoral path in a society like ours. And so we really have to put a full-fledged vision for how to actually make everybody's life better, workers of all races and ethnicities and genders. And if we don't do that, we're just going to get nowhere. And if we do it and we organize around that vision, we will win. So the question is, though, you know, people that have been, you know, there's so many people in the Democratic establishment now that have kind of been lulled into this, neoliberal, you know, intellectual sleep, that it's going to be hard to get people, you know, to do what I just said.
Yeah, and I think I'll just add briefly that, like, the vote in this election, it wasn't so much an endorsement of Donald Trump as much as it was a resounding defeat for Clintonism and neoliberalism. So now we have to resist, we have to rebuild the party, but we absolutely have to offer an alternative, because if we don't, we're never going to get out of this hole we've dug for ourselves.
I mean,
that was a lot better. Use Becky's clip instead of my monologue.
Well, but Becky, how do we? How do we keep both those tracks going? I mean, how do we avoid how do we keep the argument between those two different visions for America from inhibiting our ability to stop Donald Trump going forward?
Look, I think that there's a tremendous capacity in the grassroots to do the work necessary to change this country. And we can see it right now. People are just bursting out of their workplaces and their schools and into the streets. And they're marching because that's what people are around them are doing and what they're being asked to do. But if we ask them to get to work to, you know, overwhelm the 2018 elections and sweep in a new kind of candidate with a message that's, that addresses structural racism as well as economic inequality, that addresses climate as well as immigration reform, and brings, you know, working class people of color and working class whites together under a vision that's going to actually sort of fix some of these problems that are just so deeply broken in America, I think we can win. It's going to be hard work, and we have to start immediately. And there's plenty of energy to do that while we you know, try to oppose the worst abuses of the Trump administration. We simply have to do it all. But the good news is that if we actually invite the people to be part of these campaigns, we're gonna have the capacity to do everything we need to do.
Becky Bond, Zach Exley, the book is Rules for Revolutionaries: How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate your time today. And the book is great, and it's a great resource. And, you know, good for you guys for giving it away for far less than consultants tend to charge for these things. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. It's
like, we need shows like yours more than ever, and we're just happy to get to contribute to the kind of the work that you do, you know, every day, educating people and starting a conversation. And so we're happy to be part of that conversation with you.
Well, thank you again. I appreciate it. To get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. Speaking of Bill O'Reilly, who is got to be feeling good right now that he is going to still be at Fox and he's still the man now that Megyn Kelly is leaving.
Some more salary space is left open.
He's feeling his oats. He's got he's done the Sandy Brown thing in terms of the dyeing of the hair. He's going back to the old Red, like they used to call him back in the day. And here he is lamenting the fact that our society is so decrepit that all of the self-respecting, decent musicians and celebrities associated with our society are refusing to be a part of the Trump inauguration. He's just what we're seeing, folks. This is like, it's like Jim Crow part two.
Also not confirmed are some entertainers who reportedly believe if they show up at the New York inauguration, it'll hurt their careers.
Pause it.
Tenor Andrew.
Now, first off, you gotta like the fact that he's only reporting unconfirmed news. And the fact that he's so wasted, like, you know, it used to be he just got drunk, like, on, you know, special nights, like, you know, debates or whatnot. But now it sounds like even maybe, well, this time it was a celebratory one. I had a reason for that one because Megyn Kelly was.
Musicians can't perform. Hey, bye, fine bitch. Back to the factor.
Let's go.
Also not confirmed are some entertainers who reportedly believe if they show up at the New York inauguration, it'll hurt their careers. The tenor Andrea Bocelli has been mentioned, along with Garth Brooks, I should say. But again, we cannot confirm the fear element. However, it's obvious there's a problem, and there should not be one. The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
Oh, pause it.
That's what
not totally. I like how he says, like, yes, we're engineered by American voters, as opposed to actually a majority of them voting for them. This is the way that I get around with the whole electoral thing. They engineered it. They were like, well, we're gonna vote more in states that have less vote to electoral vote ratio, and we're going to vote less. Go.
That's what the ceremony is, not a political gesture. So all Americans should respect the process, even if you don't like the incoming president. Should never be intimidation about attending or performing at an inauguration. That is un-American.
Okay.
The election of George W. Bush in 2000 was perhaps the most controversial vote in the nation's history, decided by the Supreme Court. Yet a variety of entertainment showed up at the inauguration, including Ricky Martin, Wayne Newton, Jessica Simpson, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and the Rockettes. Even Beyonce showed up, performing with Destiny's Child at an inaugural concert for America's youth. So even though there was bitterness over the Bush-Gore race, the nation came together at the inauguration. But now that cohesive spirit seems to have changed. The harsh truth is that there is reverse McCarthyism going on in the entertainment industry. Remember that in the 1950s, Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy started accusing people in Hollywood of being communists. That led to a blacklist where people were not hired because McCarthy smeared them. Today it seems anti-Trump zealots may be doing the same thing.
Pause it.
A Trump supporter.
Now, first of all, if you're reverse McCarthyism would be you're against McCarthy. McCarthyism is this dynamic where people are made to be made pariahs because of their political beliefs.
Because, an example, they don't perform for a far-right lunatic con man as president.
Right.
That might implicate their career, as an example.
By saying, what he should be saying is, it's a form of McCarthyism that's going on. Reverse McCarthyism would be where you're not making people a pariah based upon their politics.
And when I say blacklist, I don't mean a list of black people in the building who can't touch your car. I'm talking about the bad guys.
It sounds like what he's saying is that this would be like actors and performers not willing to perform at McCarthy's, let's say, wedding or New Year's party.
Or a disciple of one of the top people on McCarthy's committee. Roy Cohn.
Yes.
Who is Donald Trump.
I think the reverse McCarthyism thing is where McCarthy was a politician persecuting the entertainers, and now it's the entertainers persecuting a politician.
I feel like someone could teach a college course on this. Continue.
You're a bad person, and a number of entertainers believe their careers will be harmed should they associate with the new Trump administration.
And of course, this is completely unconfirmed.
It's kind of confirmed. It's like some people say you can't drag your wife down the stairs by her hair. It's reverse spousal abuse.
As you know, Bill O'Reilly brings on their Fox News strategic analyst, Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters. It has come out that Devin Nunes, his supposed contact that he met on the White House grounds, because there was a skiff there or whatever it is, a secure location to look at intel. He was meeting, it sounded like he was meeting someone from the intelligence agencies. Well, it turns out he was actually meeting with the White House appointed liaison to the intelligence agencies. And Bill O'Reilly is having on Ralph Peters, who I think is, you know, I don't know that he has really any credibility, frankly, but I like the fact that Bill O'Reilly has lost control of his own narrative in these two segments. So here's Bill O'Reilly. Look at the windup. And then the ball bounces about 6 feet before the plate. Here we go.
There was a hearing in the Senate, and new information about who showed Congressman Devin Nunes classified information on the White House grounds. Joining us from Washington, Fox News.
Pause it for one second. Does he just say this with names that are not fully Americanized?
What do you think? Use your brain over there. Nunes. Sam Sador.
Colonel Peters. No, that's too American. I don't need to do that. Good.
Nunes, classified information on the White House grounds. Joining us from Washington, Fox News strategic analyst, Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters. First of all, John Roberts just sent up this to me. And this is so crazy what's going on now. And I say that because it's being used as propaganda rather than fact. Apparently, the National Security Council, and they have an office on the White House, came across a number of instances where members of the Trump campaign, including the president himself, showed up on intelligence wiretaps. That's transcripts of recorded, secretly recorded conversations. They two White House guys called Nunes, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, to the White House to look at the stuff, to look at what was thing. Nunes then said, I saw shocking stuff. It didn't have anything to do with Russia. But it was shocking, shocking, shocking. And talk to President Trump about it. Okay, so that's what happened. Is there a scandal here? Is there anything here that you're seeing as our security expert that I'm not seeing?
Well, there is a sort of scandal in the fact that this wasn't the National Security Council servicing these documents. It was a couple of Trump appointees assigned to the National Security Council. This wasn't H.R. McMaster. And it was clearly another attempt to divert attention from the main issue, which is a question of whether or not Vladimir Putin's regime was able to penetrate the Trump campaign and potentially the administration.
It's not going the way I want it.
Hold on for a second. Did anybody vet you before we came on? And so, now Bill O'Reilly is going to take a slightly different angle, and that is, I'm going to say, like, now this whole thing, though, I mean, the real scandal is with Nunes.
I'm drunk.
Is this thing.
I'm drunk.
He's going to try it from the other side now. Here we go.
Though, if Donald Trump and some high member of his transition team are caught on wiretaps, and as you know, it's supposed to be blanked out. They're not. And now they're on transcripts in our intel agencies. I think that's an important story, is it not?
No, I think it's a BS story, and it's phony, and nobody's released those.
Whoops.
What happened to you, Ralphie boy?
Folks, if you're looking for a producer of a television program, you're looking to hire one, I think one might be available in town.
What happened to Peters? We used to talk about why Barack Obama was too soft to kill kids.
Devin Nunes.
Nunes. I had you all teed up.
Guys, just going to say a bunch of ethnic, you know, ethnic, he's like Colonel Ralph. He doesn't go Colonel Ralph Peters. No, he's like Colonel Ralph Peters. Normal name. Normal name. Not Nunes.
Talking with you is like talking to my wife. I hate you.
So there you have. I mean, I frankly.
The tenor Andrea Bocelli.
Oh, gosh. Well, there you have it, folks. Just another. We got to get the D-Man on here if we're going to get control of our show. I think that's what he said. Uh, to our wheelhouse and why we're here, okay, which is, of course, talking about the last Bill O'Reilly and Dennis Miller exchange. Den has not been on the Bill O'Reilly show since September. I don't know what's going on. Do you hear anything out there, Andy?
Well, I just plugged in. Well, here's the deal. You know, there's always exciting things. Don't get thrown up by the fact that when you hit Dennis Miller and news, that there is no there's no news for Dennis Miller. And two of the news, you think, oh, I forgot to put quotes around Dennis Miller because it's not the Dennis Miller you're thinking of. But don't get thrown by that. There's always something exciting happening in Dennis Miller's career. And he was in the middle of an interview about his appearance at the River Spirit Casino Resort.
Yeah.
He launched into an old story about Saturday Night Live. And I guess it was delightful.
That's the news. That's the Dennis Miller news. Well, we have a clip from the No Spin news. This is September 21st. So this is back when they were talking about it was Kimmel, right? It was Kimmel talking about his kid and about healthcare. Let's see what happened. This is
during the salad days. This is when it's really fun to watch this.
Yeah, this is back before, I think.
Before he got bitter.
Miller got too morose. This was, you know, a couple of months ago. We should also say just a sidelight about Bill O'Reilly as you watch this to make it more enjoyable. As you know, and Bill O'Reilly without makeup is not great. You should be aware that
body shamey, Jim.
There was a report about Bill O'Reilly's contract, a testimony from a 20th Century Fox executive in some of the legal cases, that he had a clause in his contract that he could not be reprimanded for anything that was not proven in court.
I want a 10% raise, and I want to be able to call her Chocolata Mochaccino, even if she gets surly.
If it's not illegal, then I'm going to be doing it.
Yeah, so, let's not forget my joke, though, that who knew the no spin zone was meant literally for how he wanted women to act around him. Maybe it wasn't funny. It was funny 2 months ago. What the hell has happened? You know what? We went into this Louis C.K. thing, and we all feel creepy.
I know.
Louis,
I
don't even understand what you meant
let's,
by that.
I love about Bill O'Reilly's library as where he does his show? It's all his own books in the background.
Fucking awesome.
Have you ever seen David Gergen? David Gergen, whenever he gets interviewed by Skype, he always has behind him, I taught at Harvard. Oh, I'm a thing. He's got his credits behind him.
How awesome would it be if Gergen actually spoke that way? He's just like, eh.
All right, let's go. We're going to wrap this up in about 15, 20 minutes.
Why do we have to wrap it up? We should go forever with this kind of stuff.
I got Bob's today.
What's that?
Bob's. Sorry, buddy.
Oh.
I'm sorry about that. Buddy. I know you're not. All right, here we go. It's Bill O'Reilly with Dennis Miller back from September 21st.
Kill me. Be that as it may, it just demonstrates that late night TV is no longer what it was under Johnny Carson, where people in America watched that show. A lot of us did because we wanted a little, you know, relaxation and laughs before we retired. Okay, so let's bring in Dennis Miller, who knows about
that was
late
funny.
Night.
I thought that was
were you
Miller.
Ever on
that
with Carson, by
good.
The way, Miller? Did you make it on with him?
Yeah, I did the 3 appearances, I believe, with Johnny Carson.
Wow, did you meet him?
Sure. I remember once I had my mom out there with me, and there was a brief knock at the door, but not the knock of somebody who was waiting for you to come. It was the knock of somebody. It was like, boop, boop, door open, and Carson steps in. My mother, I wish we didn't have cell phones and all that, weren't as prevalent then, but just the jaw drop.
Pick up the pace, Dennis.
My beloved
Pick up
mom.
The pace.
So funny that Johnny steps in. Hey, kid.
Hold on, pause it. Wait a second.
What the hell
he
is
just
he
said,
saying?
He said
he
wished cell phones weren't
way.
As prevalent back when
in
Johnny Carson was around.
he knocked on a door in a, you know, like a bop bop way, which of course meant it was Johnny Carson. And there was less.
You're being far too animated.
Right.
He is like just sitting there, just sort of like, he can barely get
hey,
up.
Hey, Miller, did you ever meet Johnny Carson?
He's had time dilation because there was no cell phones when Johnny Carson was on air.
He knocked on the door softly.
No, but isn't it amazing how depressed he immediately sounds? You were in Johnny Carson, right, Dennis? Yeah. I mean, what the hell?
Yeah, I did.
He could make being on Johnny Carson sound boring.
I was on with one of the most iconic entertainers of our time.
And my beloved mom was so funny when Johnny steps in. Hey, kid, funny tonight? Thank you, John. That's my mother. Hey, Mr. Umbrella, you know, it's so sweet. That Midwestern side of him would come out when he would meet older folks or mothers, or you know what I mean, very well
sure.
mannered.
So, right, right.
Yeah, it was exciting. It felt like you're in show business.
Right, right. And nobody was bigger than Johnny Carson. Now, did you know what Carson's politics were? Did you ever see any political stuff out of him?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. The thing about Johnny, and I saw this referred to either in the article you sent me or another article.
I don't think he wanted black people in his neighborhood.
But he moved it along, you know?
That's a great observation. He did jokes about everything, but he moved it along.
And it was a rhythm that became America's rhythm because he was a leading practitioner. I know he would say never more than three jokes on a topic. And I know that he scored most off his self-deprecation, which was almost at some point almost built in. If there was a joke on the cusp, he'd say, "Leave it in because of the tanks." I can make fun of myself now.
Right. He's making up stuff.
Wow, this is just unbelievable. You know, Bill O'Reilly's trying to get to the point that Johnny Carson never got political, and so Jimmy Kimmel should.
Right, that's exactly right.
Dennis Miller is just going down, talking about breaking down. Like, well, he would do three jokes on a topic, and he would always keep the pace up. And
he's giving so little that I can't even pivot to make fun of him off of this one.
I thought that was you doing him. When it went back into the bank.
Let's see if this goes anywhere.
Black people.
Oh, we should tell people we don't preview this stuff. Any of
no,
us?
No, we don't know no, folks.
Because we don't want to watch it twice.
We just know it's going to be terrible.
Good.
And then the third thing I would say is he probably threw darts at all the balloons, but he didn't flamethrow or anything. You know what I mean? He moved along.
Yeah, he pricked it. And he was on during the Vietnam era, all of the controversies, but he didn't do Jack Parr. He didn't do what a lot of these talk show hosts did. He kept it light. He kept it moving, as you said. And he was unbelievably acceptable. And I think successful. And I think Americans appreciated that. Okay, flash forward to now. We got Kimmel.
Are you kidding me?
We got
Bill
Colbert and Fallon. And of the three, Colbert, his whole show is political. But that is scoring some ratings, although I must tell the audience, and you know this, they're a shadow of what Johnny Carson's ratings were. I mean, late night TV. Now, if they do 3 million a night, they're jumping up and down. Carson was doing triple that on some nights. So, what do you think about the landscape now?
Just so for people who are younger and don't understand, here's how the math works. At that time, there was one late night show. It was Johnny Carson's show. Now there are three on the three networks. So if they're each doing 3 million and Johnny Carson on some nights would do triple that, then basically what you have is that's how math works. Very often, these guys will do a third of what Jimmy Kimmel did. I mean, Johnny Carson, because there's three of them now.
Yeah, but now there's a lot more.
Well, the kids today, they don't know how to divide in three.
Yeah. Now there's a lot more TV channels, Billy, and I was eating a cookie, and then I saw a homeless guy.
If there was a joke on the cusp.
I was so upset that maybe this homeless guy might be at a shelter that my taxes came from.
All right, let's see.
Now, at late night, turning political.
Well, first off, I don't think what you just said, and I know you're true there, actually, but that doesn't mean absolutely anything, the whole universe of technology. It's like saying how many calligraphy pens were sold after Gutenberg invented the printing press. Everything's changed. Nobody's going to do Carson's number.
Bill
I can honestly say I'm not being too cool for the room here. I don't watch late night television, so I've never seen Stephen Colbert's show.
Really?
But I would think that Stephen Colbert. Yes, you could take anything I say
You might not be invited. You might not be invited on now. That's what I'm worried about. Go ahead.
I don't think I'm capable of doing it. I'm not. My chops aren't what they used to be. I certainly don't pursue late night television, and nor do they pursue me.
You don't pursue anything.
But I will say this about Colbert. I would think, from what I do see in the ratings numbers, that he would be happy, because I believe he was finishing third consistently.
Yeah, last.
Trump, and in an odd way, has resuscitated a lot of careers. I know Rachel Maddow was third, and now she's up at the top, and Colbert and Alec Baldwin seems like
O'Reilly's steaming now. Like, he just remembered, like, so
they might hate Trump, but it must be an odd thing in their head where they realize that, quite frankly, their good fortunes right now are predicated on his victory as the president.
Now, that is if the most somebody forced you that to Miller's watch late night TV, they broke into your house and you had a gun at your head. would you prefer
just the thought, you fucking prick?
I'd beg him to pull the trigger.
I would say, I don't have anything to live for anymore. Now paint my brains on the wall like the cover of the Maharishi's Beatle record.
Yeah.
That's like, no, nothing anyone said was like asking how much were calligraphy pens after Gutenberg. You can't just add a reference because you literally have nothing.
Hey, Dennis, say someone kidnapped you, put a gun to your head. Now you're talking, Billy, because I don't actually have the courage to do it myself. But if somebody forced it on me, I would say, take it. I have nothing to live for anymore.
Death by O'Reilly hypothetical.
He sounds depressed by how bad Trump is,
yeah.
Doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah,
I think
so.
That there might be 1% of Dennis Miller that is not, like, he's not becoming good by any stretch of the imagination, but
no.
He's at least starting to get how disgusting his side is.
He's coming out of it.
I hope he has a moment of clarity that he realizes that he was, I don't know what percentage, tiny percentage, somewhat responsible for Donald Trump.
I think that there's something going on. It's a fraction.
I mean, look, people, I had to explain this to Brendan today. Andy, have you met Brendan, new Brendan? You haven't met Jamie yet either, have you?
I don't think so.
Oh, we got all new
friends.
This is Brendan.
I don't believe so.
Brendan, say
hi. Hi, Andy. How's it going?
Hi, how are you?
Now, doing well. loving these bits.
Jamie is out because she had her wisdom teeth taken out. But I had to show Brendan my Dennis Miller doll that I had from 2003 when he was a hero for the right because he was, the French couldn't find a weapon of mass destruction if it was in their souffle or whatever it was that the doll would
that
say.
That was when he was really animated.
But
why don't we draw an ANWR? All of a sudden it's like, caribou's Muslims? Is that why the Democrats care about them so much? Ba-da-ba.
This would have been better material than he actually did.
Let's hear it.
To watch late night TV, they broke into your house and you had a gun at your head.
Sounds great.
Would you prefer to watch somebody who is just doing entertainment?
He's still trying to get
the Or would you
point
prefer
across.
To watch all of this social commentary, which
Pause
is almost 100%?
Pause it. I just want to remind people that the only reason why we know Dennis Miller's name is because of the social commentary he did on Weekend Update on a late night TV show. Unbelievable.
Or would you prefer to watch all of this social commentary, which is almost 100% left? Which would you, Dennis Miller, prefer to watch?
Well, you're asking me a hypothetical about something that doesn't, I just don't watch it.
I'd rather be entertained myself.
I'd rather not watch it and watch Turner Classic Movies. That's what how long have I known that many years?
The first rule of improv is
I
say
like to
yes,
watch TV
but how about
to,
this?
No.
Escape no to life, no
to the world.
You,
I don't
no
want
to
like
segment,
to be immersed in a very
no
sad world right now. Plus, the country doesn't.
Yeah,
I know.
I don't want to be immersed in a sad
Trump
world.
Trump is the president now, and there are some things that I'm more in agreement with him than liberals. I don't trust them. I don't like getting them
Trump
and all that stuff. I do think North Korea has to be reined in. I know I'm supposed to think that he's Adolf Hitler. I don't think that he's Adolf Hitler. Hitler was Hitler. So all those things lead me to a point where not only am I not that interested anymore at my age, and I am interested in Turner Classic Movies, which I watch every night, I have to go through consternation to watch late night TV, as I understand, because I think my...
All right, great. Thanks for the high-energy segment, Frank.
I'm sort of a naive rube, and I don't know who sidles up to that every night to be told they're stupid.
No. I think that's driving the audience away, and ESPN too. So Miller's on his way to Baltimore in about 2 hours. He's out on the West Coast, and I will meet him there for our big show tomorrow at the Royal Farms Arena.
Oh,
you on your game, Miller?
Terrible.
You going to be up for that?
Yeah, I've been writing jokes. I have
new stuff.
I might do a comedy special next year, and I've got a new hour, so I'm going to work on that.
Excellent. I've got new stuff. Everybody's got new stuff.
Excellent.
We'll
see you tomorrow. Here, I'm enraged at God. You're a middle-aged claustrophobic depressive.
Okay, we wrap it up now with Jerry Jones, owner of
All right, we're out of there.
You're a middle-aged...
He's not Hitler. He's not Hitler is his new thing about Trump.
Yeah, he's definitely not Hitler. You know.
Good point.
I guess that the Miller only comes on now the night before the show that they're going
to
do live.
Big show.
That's why
I
mean,
love how defeated he is, that he still is just like, I mean, as far as I'm concerned,
I just want people to understand
North Korea, but
the effort that I make and how seriously I take this program. I have a membership now to the Bill O'Reilly No Spin Show.
Oh, God.
Just for you, Andy.
I can't believe our money goes to that.
Ugh.
Are they coming to town? Oh, well, we're in different towns. But don't you think that you should send me as a correspondent of the Majority Report out to see the Bill O'Reilly, Dennis Miller
that.
Show?
Oh, God.
There's a show in December in Anaheim.
Go. You need
Andy,
to go.
If I bought you the ticket, would you go and just like and tape it with your iPhone or something?
I'd buy myself a ticket.
I'll buy you the ticket.
Will you record it with your iPhone, please?
Oh, my God.
You need to do this.
Friday, December 15th.
Oh, I can't wait.
In Las Vegas.
What's the date in Anaheim?
16th.
Anybody know?
Two shows on the 16th in Anaheim at the Honda Center.
Oh, my God.
The
and
Honda
then I feel
Center.
Like we got to hire somebody else to shoot you in that crowd.
Oh, I have to be in disguise.
There's
I
a lot
don't
of
want people. To be recognized.
Well, Andy,
I would prefer to just watch. I think we should nuke North Korea, but you know, people are so mean about it. I prefer to just watch movies.
So, Kindler, you've been writing new material. Where are you playing these days?
I've
you going to play the Chuckle Hudson?
Here's the material.
Yeah, plug your plug. What are you doing?
I'm supposed to plug my. I keep forgetting that I have a podcast. So everybody keeps saying, plug it. Not everybody. I sound like Trump now. Everyone's saying this. It's called Thought Spiral. Me and my friend Josh Elvis Weinstein. Do a podcast, and it's just me and him talking, and it's really, it's not making a little noise. There's no buzz around it, but it's definitely
it's
been
good.
Recorded.
I've listened to a couple episodes. It's funny.
Is that true?
It really is true.
I'm gonna put it on my iPod
everybody should check
right
it
now.
Out.
It's too bad we're not living in the age of cell phones.
You know, they were a lot more prevalent back then. Are you working on any new material? Yeah, I think Trump's right.
We should probably
nuke Korea, but I don't want to be
Johnny
made to feel Carson bad about it.
When he said, "I think we should rein in North Korea," it brought me back to how facile these fucking idiots were during Bush's time. Just to sort of like, we should rein in North Korea. Oh yeah, why doesn't somebody go over and pull the rein in North Korea lever that we had installed at the White House? Nobody wants to touch it because they're so lazy.
Obama doesn't do it because he's PC, Billy. But
yeah,
look, but I prefer
we
to watch
rein them in.
I prefer to watch on the water.
Just use the
try to think of reasons why I shouldn't kill myself. That's my new material. I'm going to work out in Anaheim.
That was really amazing. You know, I have to tell you, that was one of the most entertaining things I've heard. Was Bill O'Reilly threatened. He goes, if I had a gun to your head, would you do any comedy for me then?
Oh.